Good evening, everybody, and welcome. My name is Nick, and I help direct events here at The Strand. Before we launch into tonight's event with Cory Doctorow, Eva Galperin, and Ron Deibert, I'd like to share a little bit of history about The Strand. The Strand was founded in 1927 by Benjamin Bass on 4th Avenue's Book Row. Stretching from Union Square to Astor Place, Book Row gradually dwindled from 48 bookstores until, after 93 years, The Strand is the sole survivor, now run by third-generation owner Nancy Bass Wyden. We want to thank all of you for your support. Without our loyal community of book lovers, we wouldn't be here today. Tonight, we are excited to have with us best-selling author Cory Doctorow. Cory is a regular contributor to The Guardian, Locus, and many other publications. His award-winning novel, Little Brother, was a New York Times bestseller, as was its sequel, Homeland. His novella collection, Radicalized, was a CBC Best Fiction of 2019 selection. Joining Cory in conversation tonight are Eva Galperin and Ron Deibert. Eva is the director of cybersecurity at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where she leads the Threat Lab. Ron is professor of political science and director of the Citizen Lab at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy, University of Toronto. His book, Reset, Reclaiming the Internet for Civil Society, launched this week in the United States. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Cory, Eva, and Ron to the stage. Gotta unmute folks, and there we go, we're in business.
Hi, hi Eva, hi Ron.
Hi Cory.
Hi, thank you everyone who's attending. My plan here tonight is I'm going to read a little from the novel. That's the new book here, Attack Surface. Eva and Ron and I are going to have a discussion, and then we're going to open it up to questions. There's a Q&A tab where you can ask questions. I remind you that a question is not a long rambling statement followed by what do you think of that? And apart from that, I'm really looking forward to the Q&A, and I will also note that we're doing something a little different from other virtual book launches you might have attended since the plague began. The Strand is actually sending me their stock, and I'm going to sign them and put them in envelopes and mail them to you. So you're getting personalized copies from my own pen from this very office that I'm glamorously sat in at this moment. It's dark because it's a bit daggy with the lights up. All right. So the bit I'm going to read to you comes from the very beginning of the book. And it's about Masha, who is the hero slash anti-hero of this novel. And she is involved with this group of protesters in two ways. First, she's involved as a surveillance contractor. Her day job is figuring out how to help the government of this very corrupt oligarchic state spy on pro-democracy movements so they can neutralize them. And then her second gig is helping them avoid this surveillance gear. This is the kind of self-destructive thing that is probably not very stable in the people who practice it, but does give characters at the start of novels lots of problems that they can then go on to solve to propel the story forward. As the reading begins, they are at a giant protest in the square, and they are aware that there are neo-Nazi provocateurs who are coming, and that the police have a tacit arrangement to let them kick off the round of violence that can be used to justify a counterstrike. And the hero of the scene is Masha, and her sidekick is a woman named Christina, a local pro-democracy activist. The crash barricades around the square had long been colonized by tarps and turned into shelters where protesters could get away from the lines when they needed a break. Christina returned after a few minutes to lead me to an empty corner of the Warren. It smelled of BO and cabbage farts, but was in the lee of the wind and private enough. Doubling my long coat's tails under my butt for insulation, I sat down cross-legged and tethered my laptop. A few minutes later, I was in Litvinchuk's email spool. That Litvinchuk runs the communications ministry. I had a remote desktop on his computer and could have just used his email and webmail interface, but it was faster to slither into the mail server itself. Thankfully, one of his first edicts after taking over the ministry had been to migrate everyone off of Gmail, which was secured by 24/7 ninja hackers who'd eat me for breakfast, and onto a hosted mail server in the same data center I just spent 16 hours in, which was secured by wishful thinking, bubblegum, and spit. This meant that if the U.S. State Department wanted to pwn the Slovakian government, it would have to engage in a trivial hack against that machine rather than facing Google's notoriously vicious lawyers. The guiding light of Boris politics was trust no one, which meant they had to do it all for themselves. Lifenchuk's cell site simulators all fed into a big analytics system that mapped social graphs and compiled dossiers. He demanded that the chiefs of police and military gather the identifiers of all their personnel so they could be whitelisted in the system. It wouldn't do to have every riot cop placed under suspicion because they were present at every riot. The file was in a saved email. I tabbed over to a different interface, tunneled into my appliance. It quickly digested the file and spat out all the SMS messages sent to or from any cop since I'd switched it on. I called Christina over. She hunkered down next to me, passed me a thermos of coffee she'd acquired somewhere. It was terrible, and it reminded me of Marcus. Marcus and his precious coffee. He wouldn't last 10 hours in a real radical uprising, because he wouldn't be able to find artisanal coffee roasters in the melee. Christina, help me search these texts. Help me search these for texts about letting Nazis get past the lines. She stared at my screen, the long scrolling list of texts from cops' phones. What is that? It's what it looks like, every message sent from or to a cop's phone in the past 10 hours or so. I can't read it, though, which is why I need your help. She boggled, all cheekbones and tilted eyes and sensuous lips. Then she started mousing the scroll up and down to read through them. Holy shit, she said in Slovakian, which was one of the few phrases I knew. Then, to her credit, she seemed to get past her surprise and dug into the messages themselves. How do I search? Here, I opened up a search dialog. Let me know if you need help with the wildcards. Christina wasn't a hacker, but I taught her a little regular expressions foo to help her with an earlier project. Regex are one of the secret weapons of hackerdom, complex search strings that parse through huge files for specific patterns, if you didn't fuck them up, which most people did. She tried a few tentative searches. Am I looking for names, passwords? Just anything that'd freak out the Interior Ministry. We're going to forward a bunch of these onto them. She stopped and stared at me, all eyelashes. It's a joke? It wouldn't look like it came from us. It'll look like it came from a source inside the ministry. She stared some more, the hamsters running around in their wheels behind those eyes. Masha, how did you do this? We had a deal. I'd help you, and you wouldn't ask questions. I'd struck the deal with her after our first night on the barricades together, when I'd shown her how to flash her phone with paranoid Android, and we watched the stingrays bounce off it as she moved around the square. She knew I did something for an American security contractor and had Googled my connection with Mikey, whom she worshipped, naturally. I'd read the messages she'd sent to her cell chat channel, sticking up for me as a trustworthy sidekick to their Amerikansky hero. A couple of the others had wisely and correctly assumed that I was a police informant. It seemed like maybe she was regretting not listening to them. I waited. Talking first would surrender the initiative, make me look weak. If we can't trust you, we're already dead, she said finally. That's true. Luckily, you can trust me. Search. All right, and that is the reading. Ron, Eva, lovely to see you. Aw, thank you, Ron. So, you know, obviously this scene, it touches on the kind of work that both of you do. And so I wanted to start by asking a little about that. These are easy softball questions. And Eva, I thought maybe if you could tell us a story of how you got involved with the war on stalkerware and where it stands now, that would be a good place to kick us off.
All right. So once upon a time, I was doing a bunch of work tracking APTs. So I would spend my time going out into the middle of revolutions and talking to the people on the front lines and looking at their malware and trying to get some idea of how they were being spied on and running security trainings in order to help them not get spied on. So something very similar to what you're describing here. It turned out that one of the people with whom I was doing this work turned out to be a serial rapist. And I read an article with an interview with one of his victims. And what I noticed about the article was that she was really scared. and that everyone who was involved in this situation had covered up their, you know, their laptop cameras and was worried about their cell phones. And they were all afraid that this guy was going to compromise their devices, or that he had compromised their devices. And apparently he had threatened to compromise their devices in order to keep them silent. And I got really mad. And I did what most people do when they're really angry. I tweeted. And I tweeted that if you were a woman who had been sexually assaulted by a hacker and you were worried about the integrity of your device, that you could contact me and I would make sure that you got like a full forensic analysis. 10,000 retweets later, also several years later, I still get messages. But one of the things that I decided to do was really to try to deal with the problem in a more systemic way, because fixing everybody's computer or tablet or phone one at a time doesn't scale. There aren't enough me's out there, and I enjoy sleeping. So I helped to found an organization called the Coalition Against Stalkerware, and we got a bunch of different organizations together, including the companies that make antivirus software and security researchers and people who work with victims of domestic abuse and stalking on the ground. And we have them talking to each other and working together. And the first thing that we did was we made it a lot easier and a lot simpler for antivirus companies to share information with one another and to make sure that they actually picked up this stuff as malicious. And that in and of itself has been, you know, sort of a great step forward.
Yeah, there were a couple of follow-up questions really quick. So you use the term APT, and I wonder if you could define that. But also, maybe you could dig in a little to this business where the anti-malware company, the antivirus companies, refused to call this stuff malware. Can you maybe unpack that a little?
Sure. First, yes, APT stands for Advanced Persistent Threat, which is just usually our fancy way of saying a government. And all of the different APTs go under a number of different names and also have numbers because everything has been assigned by the different security companies that are doing the research. And so this can be extremely confusing to anybody who's trying to, you know, follow what governments are doing, because it feels like every group has six or seven different names. So you've got, you know, APT-28 and also Fancy Bear and also a bunch of other stuff. It's all the same guys. So that's APTs. And the second half was, why wasn't antivirus already finding this stuff? I was outraged to discover that antivirus was not very good at finding this stuff and that they simply didn't prioritize it. And the reason for that is, as the companies frequently told me, there were legitimate uses for this kind of software. And as long as there were legitimate uses, they were worried that they would be sued by the makers of stalkerware if they flagged this stuff as malicious. And one of the things that I have spent the last couple of years doing is really trying to change people's minds about whether or not this kind of software is okay. Because there was a certain sort of attitude among hackers that, like, spying on your spouse is okay, that spying on a cheating partner is okay, that it is, you know, not just within the realm of possibility, but it is within the realm of acceptable behavior. And I just want people who work in security to know that that stuff in and of itself is abusive, and it also leads to greater abuse.
Thank you, Eva. That's really smart. Ron, you work against APTs as well. You run the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto and have done some really important work uncovering the use of these commercial products to spy on people on behalf, I think, mostly of governments. And one of the things that strikes me when I look at your work is that although the tools being wielded are awesomely powerful and are supposed to be reserved for kind of state against state, spy against spy stuff, that it's used in the most petty, you know, idiotic ways. And you've caught people just doing the most petty crap. I mean, I thought it was a big deal when Snowden outed the NSA for breaking into the Greek prime minister's voicemail to rig the Olympic bid. But, you know, that kind of skullduggery looks almost, you know, serious and like statesmanlike compared to some of the stuff you've unpacked. So I wonder if you could tell us about some of these, some of the work Citizen Lab has done, where we've seen the equivalent of super weapons being used by dum-dums to do trivial things. And also how, when you uncovered some of this, you had an ex-Mossad agent come and spy on you, which is quite a tale.
Sure thing. Well, first of all, let me say thank you to The Strand. It's a pleasure to even be here virtually at my favorite bookstore in the world. And also a pleasure to be on a panel with you, Eva, and congratulate you on your work on Stalkerware, among many other things. And Corey, congratulations on this awesome book. It's really fantastic. The work that we do at Citizen Lab, one of our primary focuses is on what we call targeted threats. And that's basically tracking as best we can the APT groups that Evo just described. And, you know, it's interesting. As I read this book, I was thinking about the kind of, you know, the way in which the lead character, Masha, kind of moves seamlessly between these two worlds of activism and also intelligence and commercial surveillance. And, you know, there's definitely a kind of Jekyll and Hyde character to all of that. And in fact, you know, when reflecting on the Citizen Lab and how it all came about, you know, it's a story I've often told, but I was very much influenced by an immersion I had myself in that world of intelligence as a very young graduate student. I did some very minor kind of consulting work for the Canadian Foreign Affairs Ministry in the intelligence division. And I got to know this world of signals intelligence and electronic intelligence gathering. And I thought about, you know, why couldn't there be something like this that's done on behalf of citizens, where we're watching the governments themselves? And over time, you know, I attracted people to the lab who had these extraordinary skills to do the type of work that we do. And the thing about all of this is that, you know, even bad actors, even the most sophisticated, advanced persistent threats, have to operate over this electronic infrastructure that is insecure, poorly regulated, prone to abuse. They leave digital trails wherever they go. And if you know where to look and how to look, you can unearth a lot of bad stuff that's going on. And it's true, there's some hilarious stuff. Like there was one case where Bill Marzak, one of the lead researchers, was able to have access to a server that was not password protected. And one of these threat actors, actually, it was the company, an Israeli company called Cyberbit, that was servicing surveillance technologies to a bunch of bad government actors and autocrats around the world. They left part of their infrastructure basically open so we could view everything that was going on, including their own demonstration laptop that they were taking with them as they went to try to pitch their products to a rogues gallery of dictators. And so we could follow them as they would go to like the Radisson Hotel in Uzbekistan, you know, and like everyone does, you know, you check into your hotel, you got a big presentation the next morning, boot up your laptop, make sure it's, you know, working properly. We could see that laptop checking in. Oh, it's 11:20 from the Radisson, you know, in Uzbekistan. And then, you know, they get up, have their coffee, check it again in the morning, and then go to the Secret Service office. And we're like, okay, I guess they're hoping that the Uzbek Secret Service will purchase their crappy spyware. On the other hand, though, I would be remiss if I didn't say, as, numbskull as some of these operators are and some of the surveillance vendors are, there are very serious, indeed, even lethal consequences of what we're seeing. And I'd go so far as to say, to me, this is the most serious threat to global civil society right now, is you have this unbridled capacity that's being marketed to government agents to effectively get inside the networks and neutralize the people who are their opposition, regardless of wherever they live. So in, you know, decades past, a person might be able to flee a country and have a reasonable degree of safety in a place like Canada. Now that's not the case. They can get inside their bedrooms, inside their laptops, inside their social networks. And even if they don't, there's now this insidious fear that has kind of crept in to the civil society networks that Eva and I work with quite regularly, people are afraid. They're afraid to use the devices they hold in their hand. They're worried that somebody's looking back at them. Is this attachment something suspicious? I don't know. You know, there's all sorts of contradictory advice going around. So there is a very serious consequence to all of this that's happening that I think is important to emphasize.
Yeah, thank you. Can you quickly tell us the story about the ex-Masonic? Yeah.
Well,
you got on the front page of the newspaper?
Again, this is one of those wacky things that, you know, when you look at it from afar, it looks to be like some kind of, you know, comedy show. Basically, for us, though, it was quite, and I would go so far as to say it still is quite frightening to be looking over your shoulder, wondering, you know, getting into an elevator, is this person somebody I can trust? Basically, what happened is someone reached out to one of the staff members at the lab under false pretenses. The lab member came back, reported that this was suspicious. They had a meeting at a fancy restaurant. We did some initial, looking at the credentials and so on, realized that this was a false identity. And then 2 weeks after that, they made a second outreach to a second Citizen Lab staff member. And in this case, you know, I always say, if there is one person in the Citizen Lab team you would not want to target in this way, it's John Scott Railton. And so JSR, as we love to call him, went on the offense. He is among the best on our team in terms of open source intelligence gathering and so on. And along with Raphael Satter at Associated Press, we organized a meeting with this fake identity in a Manhattan restaurant and organized a counter sting and basically outed the person's identity. He turned out to be working for a company called Black Cube, which is made up mostly of ex-Mossad agents, notorious for, among other things, being contracted by the convicted rapist Harvey Weinstein to spy on those who allege sexual abuse and rape and so on. So, you know, a horrible company serving a lot of dubious characters. Unfortunately, we ended up in their spotlight as well, which was very unpleasant for us. And kind of a nasty underside of what we do.
You're right that the AP story has some, you know, French farce notes, right? Where like, you were the AP reporter confronted him and he ran outside and then realized he hadn't paid the bill and had to come back in.
Yes.
And just all kinds of hilarious, ridiculous things. But it's terrifying to think that you're in the crosshairs. You know, the NSO group, who I think it's presumed he was working on behalf of, they legally threatened me over stuff that I wrote about them. And, you know, the idea that you are in the crosshairs in any way of someone who's got the money, the power, the technological expertise, and so on, is very frightening, which brings me really to the follow-up questions I wanted to ask. So I'm a great fan of Lawrence Lessig's idea that the world changes through four forces, through code, what's technologically possible, law, what's lawfully permissible, norms, what's socially acceptable, and markets, what's profitable. And it feels like the three of us, we operate in all of those domains. Sometimes we advocate for or against laws, or we tell businesses they should or shouldn't engage in commercial practices, or we tell people that things are or aren't right. And we try to make tools as well. And I wanted to maybe in each of those domains ask you, what do you think we can do to make the world better, right? What, like, is there a law, for example? I know, Eva, you know, you've done a lot of work with people who have different ideas about Wassenaar and cyber weapons. Is there a law or the contours of a law or an enforcement regime that you think would tilt the balance for technology towards human liberation and away from human oppression? And then I'm going to do that for technologies and also for norms and also for markets. What businesses should people start or get out of?
Am I starting this?
Sure, yeah, that'd be great.
All right, here we go. I think that the single most important thing that we really need to defend right now is strong end-to-end encryption. Strong end-to-end encryption is under attack, not just in the United States, but throughout the EU and in other countries as well. Basically, once every 6 months, this horrible zombie idea that governments should have backdoor access to our end-to-end encrypted communications because terrorists exist or bad people exist exist or child molesters exist. It's always some sort of monster is the reason why they need to have this access. Every 6 months, this idea comes up, and every 6 months, EFF has to get everybody together in order to cut its head off. And we're getting another round of that because law enforcement is very persistent. Again, the real problem with backdooring end-to-end encryption is that you can't build a backdoor that only the good guys can walk through. Once you create a backdoor, it is a backdoor for everybody. And the kind of research that I do and the kind of research that that Ron has done over the years proves that. We are living evidence that this is absolutely the case. And so we spend a lot of time trying to stop people from carrying out this very bad idea.
Yeah, I mentioned that Snowden outed the NSA I think it was the CIA, for spying on the Prime Minister of Greece. They used a backdoor called Kalia. That in America, there's a law that says most switches have to have a law enforcement backdoor, and it's not the law in Greece. So the switch had that turned off. But because they designed it so that it could have a backdoor, the adversary was able to turn the backdoor on and then use the backdoor to spy on the Prime Minister. And, this seems to me to be like all the proof we need that there is what cryptographers call the unquantifiable risk of introducing deliberate vulnerabilities into systems that you want to be as strong and secure as possible, because the stakes are very, very high. So, Ron, is there a legal intervention that you think would make your work easier or make the work of the people you are adverse to harder?
That's a good question. I mean, in hypothetical terms, there certainly is. I think, both Eve and I would love to see stronger export controls and international regulations against the sale and servicing of commercial surveillance technologies. Unfortunately, the world being what it is right now, and global governance basically in a mess writ large, and also the fact that most of the countries that would have to initiate some kind of legislation at the international level have a dog in this race. That's mm-hmm. the real uncomfortable truth of, my own country, Canada, speaks a lot of high-minded principles at international forums. I'd be on these panels with, human rights first, internet policies. And then I'm thinking, well, meanwhile, back home, our Signals Intelligence Agency is part of the Five Eyes Alliance and is doing the very things that Eva just described about weakening encryption. So as it stands now, it's more like a wish, a dream, maybe in a different world we could have this. So I don't think when it comes to the type of hard edge problems that we're dealing with, a specific, export control regulation is viable in the current climate, unfortunately. We have made some progress in the Vosinar arrangement, but this is still something that countries basically, volunteer to commit themselves to. And we've seen it contradicted routinely in practice, right?
Can you just define Vosinar really quickly?
Vosinar is a large international, it's an arrangement, right, of governments that got together. And originally this was to control trade in dual use technologies that we traditionally associate with like nuclear weapons programs. So say ballistic missile components. And back in, I think it was 2014 or 2015, it was modified to include some language about intrusion software, what we're talking about right now. The language was, I think, poorly constructed. The intention was good, but a lot of us who do security research were concerned. For example, the type of scenario I just described where one of the Citizen Lab researchers is examining the infrastructure and, we're receiving malware to do the research that we do, we might have been liable in some way. And we thought that this would chill security research. So we had some problems with the language around it. But the bigger issue was really the fact that most of the governments that sign on to this are routinely violating it back home. So as we speak, while reading your book, I can't help but say, this reminds me of Belarus, what's going on right now, right? And in Belarus, as we speak, there's a Canadian-US company, Sandvine, whose deep packet inspection technology is being used by the authorities to shutter the internet, to slow down certain protocols and so on. This is a Canadian company, right? This is mm-hmm. a company that's owned by American shareholders and business partners. So, you know, if America and Canada can't stand up and do the right thing, you know, it's going to be pretty tough. There's, things look a bit better in Europe, but right now it's kind of bleak at that level.
What about the civil system? What if Belarusians could have a cause of action against Sandvine in the Canadian or American courts?
Well, see, that's different. I think one of the few remaining areas that I feel kind of positive about is litigation. So, for example, after it was discovered by WhatsApp that NSO had this exploit, this insidious no-click exploit, they'd simply ring up a phone using WhatsApp and they'd be able, through a flaw in then WhatsApp's protocol, take over anyone's device. WhatsApp and Facebook have sued NSO Group, and the court proceedings are going on in U.S. court. That's different. You know, exercising existing litigation could actually punish some of these companies and really hurt their bottom line. I think as it stands now in the short term, that seems to be one of the most promising avenues.
Yeah, so that's very interesting, and it takes me to the next domain, which is markets, right? Is there a way that we could structure markets through liability, through investment, through some other means that you think would create incentives that would make people make better technology or make people do less bad technology? Either one of you want to start there.
Eva? Well,
sure. A couple of things. So the first is you should protect end-to-end encryption, protect strong encryption for everyone. And do not build backdoors or make exceptions just because bad people exist in this world, because I assure you that the person you want least to walk through that back door will be walking right through it in no time. And we have many, many examples of this. So I think that's really the most important thing. Private cause of action, again, also very important. I think EFF is just about to file an amicus with the Supreme Court in a case involving Nestle that has to do with whether or not there is a private cause of action when you do something like this. And I think Citizen Lab is also contributing pretty much a large pile of research, just sort of pointing at their research and going, no, everything that we have done for the last several years is this.
What about technology funds? What about things like the maybe dead now OTF and governments or other funders funding, paying people to build end-to-end? Do you think that that's a useful intervention? Is there a way to make it better?
I think that it is potentially very dangerous to close that intervention down. I think it's been really successful so far. That we don't need for everything that OTF has ever funded to become universally used and accepted in order to consider it to be a success. The most important thing about OTF is that it maintains a community of people doing open source work who are interested in protecting civil society from its biggest threats. And without OTF, there's a lot less reason to do that, because everybody who does this work also has to have a day job.
And just to sketch this out, the OTF was a fund operated by the U.S. government that funded things like Signal and other privacy and human rights technologies. Tor, yeah.
A lot of research, too.
And a lot of research and events. And they got lost in a kind of Trumpian plot not to actually do anything about OTF, although there's a little bit of that at the margins, but it seems like the main target was to move American foreign media, like Voice of America, into the hands of far-right parties. Yeah. And that just because this was structured underneath it, it became a kind of inadvertent casualty or semi-deliberate casualty of that. Ron, in terms of markets, are there funders, things that people buy, things that people shouldn't buy, ways that we could structure the rules of markets that you think would improve the outlook for technology and human rights?
Yeah, I think I'd answer that this way. If we're talking about market interventions, I think we have to face the kind of painful truth that a lot of the reason that we have these horribly exploitative things going on, whether it's stalkerware or the type of spyware that Citizen Lab has been researching, is because the ecosystem upon which everybody now depends is one that is insecure, poorly regulated, prone to abuse, and invasive by design. And that means if we're going to fix the problem, we need to get at the root of the problem, and that is surveillance capitalism. So I think we need to, you know, wake up and understand that the business model that's been structuring all the platforms that we use on a daily basis, the devices that we carry in our hands, has this insidious logic at its core that unless we modify in some manner, maybe that's through antitrust regulations, maybe it's through some kind of accompanying interventions, maybe it's through the creation of alternative forms of social media that don't rest on surveillance capitalism. Until we get at that core problem, we're going to be continuously surfacing these and other issues, I would say.
I think that's well said. I know that when I speak in Silicon Valley about privacy, oftentimes people will say, well, I don't care if Google's spying on me. They just want to make my ads better. But Uncle Sam, that's where all the people who aren't smart enough to work in Silicon Valley go. I don't want those, you know, thick-fingered Bulgarians spying on me. And then, you know, if I give a talk in New York, if I give a talk at West Point, you know, guys with haircuts like mine say, well, you know, I had to give up all of my secrets to the government to get my security clearance. That's fine with me. They signed my paycheck. But, you know, those venal bastards out in Silicon Valley would sell their mother for a nickel. I don't want them spying on me. And I look around and I see like Ring giving data to police. I see cops serving warrants on Google to get keyword warrants or location warrants where they tell me everyone who is in a location, or everyone who searched for a certain thing. I'm like, there is no government and private surveillance. There is private surveillance that feeds governments and governments that exercise forbearance against private surveillance so that they can plunder their surveillance troves. And the distinction seems very artificial to me. All right, lightning round, because and then we'll go to Q&A. So the next question is code. What technology, you know, end-to-end is a given, but what project isn't built yet that should be built? Or what project needs a bunch of maintainers that should be working on it? Again, this isn't like in a vacuum, right? In combination with other things, what code could make the internet more safe for human thriving? And again, I'll leave it to you to work out the order.
Eva, please go ahead.
Oh, sure. This is actually a conversation that we have at EFF all the time. We quite regularly have meetings where, well, honestly, Corey gets up in front of us and says this, and then we come up with things that we think will be good for the internet. And right now, the things that I find most interesting and most worthwhile are some web add-ons that allow you to gather forensic evidence and that allow you to report the kind of things that you are seeing online. Because one of the biggest problems with civil society that I've had for many years is that people will walk up to me and say, I'm being targeted, or I have seen this thing, or this terrible thing has happened to me. And I say, can you send me screenshots? Can you send me the, you know, full headers of that email? Can you send me the, you know, attachment? And they go, no, I deleted it. And so we need to have places for all of these things to go, and we need to have a place where they can report it so that we can make use of it. And the more we understand the threats to civil society, the more we can engage in sort of counter-surveillance.
And Ron, what code intervention would you see if you could wave a wand?
Oh, well, what Eva just described actually would be like on my, you know, wish list for birthday or something, because we struggle with this all the time in exactly the same fashion. But, you know, actually, I would like to see some of the bright minds who read your books and are watching this now come up with something like I saw in passing today a little essay, can't remember what publication it was in, about how we need to think about social media platforms as something like public parks.
Eli Pariser. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, there you go. And this, you know, seemingly basic idea, I think, needs some shepherding. And it's something that we need to kind of recover the sense of stewardship over our public spaces. And after all, we are now communicating through, you know, a labyrinth of privately operated infrastructure all the way between, you know, these microphones in my ear down through the laptop sitting in front of me out through the ecosystem. And I think we need to kind of, you know, redesign it from the ground up. I can't do that. But people reading your books, people who read Eli's essay today, maybe they would be inspired to do so.
Yeah, one of the things that often comes up when I talk about net neutrality and municipally owned fiber with people on the right is they say, well, I don't want the government getting involved in running the private internet. And then in the next breath, they'll say, what do we do about the fact that everyone I love is being kicked off of Facebook for saying things that Facebook doesn't like? And I'm like, you know that in America, there's a First Amendment. And if the government owned it, maybe they'd spy on it or do something else, but they would be legally enjoined from using politics to select speech. Like if you had a 100 gigabit fiber loop in your city and you wanted to host 8chan, you could host it in your basement. And the city couldn't disconnect you unless they were also disconnecting everyone who exercised all political speech, right? Mm-hmm. They can have a rule against politics, but they can't have a rule against your politics. And, right. And you know, I'm not saying this would be an unalloyed good or an unalloyed bad, but it seems like a point that's it's often lost on people who rail against any public ownership of parts of the infrastructure, mm-hmm. is that governments are actually bound by rules about speech discrimination that private actors are not. You know, the terms of service can say by being dumb enough to come to my house, you know, I get to punch you in the mouth and wear your underwear. But you know, the Constitution binds the government. And that's a much stricter straitjacket in many ways. Okay, so last question. Normatively, an attitude that we could shift. You know, for me, it's like the idea that you would make using Facebook to participate in something like a kid's birthday party morally unacceptable, like having that kid's birthday party in the smoking section of a cigar store, right? Like it's just exposing the attendees to harm for no good reason. And anyone with a smidgen of common sense would know that you wouldn't do it. So what's your normative intervention to make the internet safer for human thriving?
Well, I have two things. One is obviously related to my work in stalkerware, where I'm really trying to get people to understand that installing stalkerware on somebody's phone in order to spy on them, even if you think that they are cheating on you, is not okay. That in and of itself constitutes abuse. You would be amazed at how often I have to say this. And the other thing that I would really like to see people do is to use long, strong, unique passwords and two-factor authentication for all of their accounts. And I think that would definitely go a long ways towards securing a lot of the compromises that I see at civil society.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to see on the other side that software developers would universally allow long, strong, secure passwords, that when you generate 128 characters of random noise, you don't get an error message back saying passwords are capped at 16 characters, and also you can't have curly braces in them or whatever. You know, it'd be very nice to
every 30 days.
Yeah, that's right. And also you have to rotate them every 30 days, and you have to generate them on your phone, where which is the least secure device you have. Ron, how about you? Normatively, what would you like to see?
I have two as well, and I'll be very quick. One is with respect to this really degenerate selfie culture around parents and their children. So you know, I see in my extended family, you know, these proud parents, and I'm not blaming them because they're very proud, obviously, but basically taking pictures of their children from the moment they're born, feeding their biometric data into the machine so that they can become, you know, objects of analysis and surveillance for the big platforms. I wish people would understand that they're doing this without the consent of that very young person whose data is no longer theirs, even before they can speak and give informed consent. The other one has to do with hacktivism. I'd be remiss if I didn't make this point here, that I'd love to see people embrace the spirit of hacktivism, as I understand this ethic of experimentation, curiosity about what goes on inside the technology that comes shrink-wrapped, that we're forbidden from opening up. And I swear I'm not saying this just to suckhole to you, Corey, but this would go right into the right to repair. which I know is a favorite topic of yours. And of course, we need to be able, in a world where, like never before, surrounded by digital technologies, and yet perversely, we're discouraged by laws and other regulations from peering inside the devices that surround us, the platforms that surround us. We need to shatter that myth, encourage a new norm of experimentation and curiosity.
That is very well said. And I'll point out to people attending, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has a network of affiliates called the Electronic Frontier Alliance, where organizations get together and create these local hacktivist initiatives around issues of local interest, whether that's banning facial recognition cameras or making the cops consult when they do new surveillance gear acquisition, or you know, doing local educational initiatives and so on. There, it's a fantastic network that shares ideas and support and tools and expertise, and has a couple of really great full-time activists at EFF who work as organizers for them. So now is the time where we come to questions. There are a couple in here. I encourage our viewers to add their own. And the first one is about from Ryan Partridge, and he asks, how did I get fluent in all of this kind of hackery technology? And I think this is something that that all three of us can certainly weigh in on. You know, for me, I grew up with computers. You know, I grew up in Toronto. My dad was a computer science teacher in a suburb called Scarborough. And in 1979, Apple very cannily gave all the heads of computer science an Apple II Plus to take home for the summer, in the hopes that they would replace their current pedagogy, which involved having high schoolers bubble in punch cards and then mailing them off to the university to be run on the computer. And you get your box of punch cards back with the paper showing where your computer broke, your program broke, and you would make new punch cards that they would replace us with an Apple II Plus. And so that was, you know, my early experience. But being a blogger really is it. You know, I as I move through the world, encounter all kinds of really interesting technology uses, stories, breakdowns, and so on. And writing about them for strangers on a blog, or writing about them for a notional stranger, even when no one was reading it, required me to approach it with enough rigor that I could explain it to a third party, which meant that it stuck in my own head. And then that process, that mnemonic process, gives you a kind of super saturated solution of these fragmentary ideas that stick together and that bubble up, so that as subjects come along, you find the connections to the things that you've already been working on. And so, you know, that happens both in my work, where I'll be writing a blog post and I'll find connections that I didn't know were there. And of course, your blog is a searchable database of all the times you've done this before, so it makes it easy. But also in conversation, in interventions, and in longer, more substantive things like novels. And you know, Ron and Eva, I don't think either of you have a formal computer science background, right? Is that right? Yeah. So I'd love to know how you became the awesome defenders of digital freedom that you are.
Oh, I was left as a feral child on the internet, unsupervised. No, I am a geek raised by geeks, and very early on, I got access to my local university's network, in spite of being 12, and that was kind of how I saw the world, and it really saved me as a child, because I was so weird and I was so out there that the internet was the only place where I could find my people. And I think that a lot of people have that experience nowadays, of the world shrinking and getting smaller because of technology, and technology helping them to find their people, and just making childhood that much less traumatic.
Yeah, our friend Dana Boyd at Data and Society, she says that sometimes we see people have a pathological relationship to technology, or what seems like a pathological relationship to technology, because they're very sad and they use technology all the time. We got the causal arrow going the wrong way. They are sad, so they're using technology because their lives around the people they're surrounded by are unhappy, and they're finding their people online. And it's really important when we look at the way people use technology that we, even if we see someone in a bad situation, that we try to understand whether the technology is the thing they're using to make their life better, or whether it's the cause of their life getting worse. How about you, Ron?
So I think my roots go back to my East Vancouver street days as a youth. I was a punk and I played in punk bands, and we had to really DIY the technology, repairing amps, you know, four track studios and microphones and things like that. So I got my, you know, enjoyment around and fascination with the inner workings of technology through those experiences. But then later it was really through the students that I taught when I got to the University of Toronto, and really the first person who kind of opened my eyes and was the first employee, the first researcher at the Citizen Lab, Nart Villeneuve, who himself was a self-trained hacker, not a computer scientist, but he knew the insides and outsides of the internet better than anyone I knew. And he really blew my mind. And so I hired him. He was my first hire, and really set the foundation for the type of technical work that we do at the Citizen Lab.
That's amazing. You know, I used to pal around in Toronto with a punk rock dumpster diver named Darren Atkinson. He was the subject of the first story I ever sold to Wired magazine.
Oh, wow.
And he started off harvesting amps from yes. Bose, who would if they had an amp come back, they would smash four of the cones with a hammer and leave one intact and throw it out. And totally. He would find five amps and harvest the one good cone and build an amp. But he found it was during the 386 to 486 transition. And he found so many 386 motherboards that he started yard selling them. And wow. He fell in with all of these computer science kids, electrical engineering kids from Ryerson, who showed him, first of all, that he was being ripped off by his buyers, that they were paying him a fraction of what these devices were worth. And second of all, that he was that they could fix them and they could turn them into complete systems. And by the time I met him, he was making $250,000 a year pulling semi-complete systems out of garbage cans and in Toronto's industrial suburbs. And the only things he got everything. It wasn't just tech. You know, I went out with him one night and we got Shiseido gift baskets that had one thing taken out of them and then returned. And we got, you know, literally he drove an old armored car that he bought at an auction. And we filled the armored car with Shiseido. But the one thing he couldn't get was toys. Hasbro and Lego had the best security of wow. any of the companies in Toronto's industrial suburbs.
Amazing.
So we have another question here from, whoops, that was the wrong button. We have another question. That's why my computer science degree is honorary. Okay, here's a good one. What are the good documents or things to point out to parents and schools to learn about the outcomes of sharing millions of photos of kids and students, specifically when schools ask students for random selfies with family members for the schools? That is a very good question. And that's from Kushal. Do you guys have any ideas there? I have a few ideas, but I'll throw to you guys first.
Well, let's hear yours. We've been answering all that.
So one of the things one of the weird things about the lockdown is it exposes a lot of the fracture lines in our world. One of those big fracture lines that I work on a lot at EFF is the lack of competition. You know, the short version is that Ronald Reagan had a court sorcerer named Robert Bork who said that we shouldn't enforce anti-monopoly laws. And his idea became doctrine because it made rich people happy. And 40 years later, the internet is five giant websites filled with screenshots from the other four. And not having competition means that there's one platform that virtually every lockdown school is using, and that's Google Classroom. And that's got all kinds of problems, but one thing that you can do to make a difference is if you type into your favorite search engine, Electronic Frontier Foundation, Google Classroom privacy settings, and then find out who configures Google Classroom for your school district. At the stroke of a keyboard, they can change the privacy settings for every student in the district to limit Google's long-term collection and retention of every student's data in the environment. And so, you know, I worry about selfies and I worry about all that other stuff, but in terms of bang for your buck, there is someone at your school district who understands technology. That is their job. And somewhere in your school, in your city or county or region, there is a policy telling them not to gather data unnecessarily and not to give it to companies if they don't have to. And you can show them how they can, in just a few keystrokes, turn that policy into action in a way that will have lasting effect on every single learner in your school district. You don't even have to be a parent to do it, although I think it's louder when it comes from parents. Neither of you guys have any thoughts on this?
No, I was just going to point people towards our, you know, student privacy work.
And oh, yeah, sure.
I would encourage people to sort of keep track of the technology that is being used by their schools, especially since so many students have been moved to distance learning in the last year or so. I encourage security researchers to look at these platforms, because frequently they are not built with security or privacy in mind, because the stakeholders are not the children. The stakeholders are usually the people who control spending for a school district.
Yeah, I would just echo that. I think that, you know, when it comes to technology and the pandemic, most people are focusing, for good reasons, on contact tracing applications. But in fact, my biggest concern is not to do with contact tracing. It's the way in which we are sleepwalking into a reliance on what is already a dumpster fire of an ecosystem, and really accentuating and amplifying all of the pathologies of that ecosystem. If I sit in my house and look at all of these Amazon packages going up and down my neighborhood, and we're really, you know, bolstering this monopoly, as you put it, with all of its terrible labor and environmental practices. My son, who's an undergraduate at a university, is required to undertake exams with this remote surveillance proctoring technology that monitors his eyeballs and makes sure he's not cheating or looking off camera or whatever. This stuff really discriminates against historically marginalized people, people who live in households that are packed with others, and you know, they have difficulty keeping rooms quiet, and they get flagged for cheating and so on. Horrible stuff is happening on the margins. It's not in the most obvious places. It's in these other, you know, little gutter alleys that things are happening that I worry the most about.
I'm so glad you brought up that remote proctoring, that invigilation software. In your old stomping grounds, I believe at UBC, it might be Simon Fraser, there's a prof called Ian Linklater who criticized Proctorio, which is one of the largest of these invigilation companies. The CEO of Proctorio has already done things like doxed students who are complaining about his software in Reddit. But they sued him for linking to the unlisted YouTube videos that explain just how creepy Proctorio actually is. And you know, I think that it's important to point out that these high-stakes exams that Proctorio is proctoring have no sound pedagogical basis. You know, both my parents have doctorates in education. My mom ran the province-wide K-3 evaluation system for the Ministry of Ed in Ontario. And no one who does this believes that this kind of test-taking produces a good and thick account of learning that can be used accurately for assessment and intervention, let alone for ranking, let alone for predicting future outcomes. And so, you know, what a tragedy, right? It's not just that we're doing this to attain education. We've decided that education is worth sacrificing this. We're doing it for witchcraft, right? We're doing it for superstition and inertia, because we've always tested, so we will always test. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I've ever scored better than 51% on a test. So, you know, my daughter is doing remote learning and missed some assignments, and her grade wasn't great. And we had a family discussion about it. And I was forced to point out that in the ninth grade, I won a Board of Education wide ninth grade to grade 13, back when Ontario had five senior grades, short story competition. And that year I got a 51% in English, because my teacher felt that failing me after that achievement would have been a kind of nonsense.
So
she found a pretense to bump me up. So yeah, that the invigilation stuff is definitely another area where, as a parent, if you want to talk to the administrators, the teachers, and the other parents in your district about something that actually makes an enormous difference in the way that privacy and human rights will intersect with the learning of all the students in your district, that's your way to do it. Todd wants to know about great activist and technology literature. I obviously have some favorites. I really had my mind blown by a book called The Hacker Crackdown. It was Bruce Sterling's book about the founding of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, among other things. Also, that time, the Secret Service raided Steve Jackson Games because they thought a role-playing game was a manual for cybercrime, and many other amazing things. And Bruce did something remarkable. Bruce actually made it what he called literary freeware before there were Creative Commons licenses. He wrote his own license that basically said, use it, but don't make money off of it, or I'll come and find you, and released it into the world. And it had a profound effect on many people. I basically dropped out of university within about 6 months of reading that and ended up working at Electronic Frontier Foundation about 7-8 years later. So that was, it was a hugely influential book for me. I actually read an entire audiobook of it into my podcast some years ago, including the central element of it, which was a memo AT&T wrote to the Baby Bells about how to administer their 911 systems that the government claimed was a $250,000 theft, and which turned out that Bell Labs was selling for $12 to hobbyists. But it's also absolutely the most boring thing you have ever read. It took half an hour to read, and I had to drink 7 cups of coffee to keep from falling asleep while I read it. It's quite an amazing piece. Either of you have any hacker lit favorites?
Oh, I do. I have a very unconventional one.
All right.
I don't even know if this fits into the genre, but I'm going to put out there Lewis Mumford, The Pentagon of Power, which is volume 2 of The Myth of the Machine. This is a book, when I first read it, that blew my mind. It's about technology and civilization. So it's broad sweep of history and technology. And obviously, Mumford is not a fan of bureaucratic rationalization. He'd be horrified if he was alive today of what's going on with surveillance capitalism. But the coolest thing about this book, which I assigned in one of my first year courses, was that it was a very plain cover that had Pentagon of Power. And I always imagined my students getting on the Toronto subway carrying this big, thick book, and people would think they're part of some strange cult.
And Eva?
I have a couple of favorite hacker books, but I think that the most interesting books are the ones that give you insight into sort of how a culture works. So I recommend the work of James Bamford, a man who wrote, I think, 3 or 4 books about the history of the NSA, which were particularly interesting. I think by the 4th one, he had pissed off the NSA so much they were not letting him write any more books. They were like, well, that wasn't very flattering, was it? Well, stop sucking. very, very short version. And the other book that I recommend is a book called Dark Market, which is a book about sort of the history of credit carding forums on the internet and sort of internet crime over, I would say, the last decade and a half. And a lot of the time people ask me, so what does this have to do with internet activism? And it's really quite simple. The exact same methods that are used to catch criminals are the methods that governments use in order to target activists. Uh-huh. And so activists need to protect themselves as if the government used them as criminals.
That's really well said. I also, since we mentioned Dana Boyd's work before, I'll mention her doctoral dissertation, which was published by MIT Press under that It's Complicated, which is an also answers one of the earlier questions about education. And her mentor and professor was Mizuka Ito, who undertook the largest ever study of how American marginalized kids use computers and networks. Hmm. And that was published under something called the Digital Youth Project. It's old now, it's 15 years old, but some of the points are very enduring. Among them, she talks about how people want to know how technology affects kids' brains, right? This kind of neuroessential view of it. And she says, look, maybe it does, right? Maybe iPads change your kids' brains. We will have to wait until they're old people to find out. by which point iPads won't exist anymore. So, like, we will have learned something for sure, but not anything that, like,
irrelevant.
This is a, yeah, it's an important neurological question. It just has no relevance to your parenting. All right, we are at the nearly at the hour mark here. I'm going to ask we're luckily also at the last question here, which comes from Michael, who wants to know, how do we feel about being involved in democratic activity, from voting to participating in protests, where it's, you know, between license plate readers and MC catchers and facial recognition, it feels like activities that are about doing stuff in public nevertheless produce an audit trail that might invite reprisals in ways that those institutions were not designed to operate under. And I struggle with this myself. I have a green card. I'm not a US citizen. I'm about 5 or 6 months away, assuming that the law remains intact and that America remains intact. But I have not gone to any protests. I worry that if I were to go to a protest and someone else did something, that I might fall under a veil of suspicion and that it would create a black cloud over me. And I grew up in the protest movement. When I was 5 years old, they told me I was going to march at my aunt's wedding and asked me if I knew how to do that. And I mimed carrying a placard and walked up and down shouting, "Not the church and not the state. Women must control their fate." So, you know, this is like, this was in my mother's milk, quite literally. And so it feels weird to be in a moment in which the streets are alive with protest and for me to be sheltering in place. But I wonder if you folks have any thoughts on this.
I have some thoughts because prior to this, I spent a lot of time traveling all over the world and taking part in protests, in demonstrations, meeting with the people who were there to speak truth to power. And I don't think that the United States is any different. I think it is important to get out there and to protest, but that we also need information about how we are being spied on, about what is happening with the information that is gathered at protests, about how police are spying on phones during protests, so that we can do the right kinds of counter-surveillance. EFF has a project called Surveillance Self-Defense that you might want to take a look at, and that includes a whole bunch of our advice about how to prepare yourself for a protest, and how to prepare your electronic devices in advance. But the most important thing that you need to think about before you go out there is, what kind of protest do you want to have? What kind of risk is acceptable to you? A protest is sort of a menu. Sometimes you're there to, you know, show up and wave a placard around, and sometimes you're there to engage in civil disobedience, and you expect to be arrested, or you expect to be tear gassed, or any one of a number of other extremely unpleasant things. And you need to prepare differently depending on what kind of outcome you anticipate.
Yeah, I always go to figure out new rhymes for 1, 2, 3, 4 myself. Ron.
So I have in my new book, Reset, I have a section about policing. And I actually think one of the most overlooked aspects of the digital revolution that we're going through is the way it's contributing to this great leap forward in technologies of policing. Thanks to surveillance capitalism, in part, and all of the, you know, the attack surface that it opens up for bad actors and some of the surveillance companies, but also the cybersecurity military industrial complex, which has really been taking off, especially since 9/11. We're in another wave of this right now. So we have this kind of hyper superpower policing governed by 20th and 19th century safeguards. And I think it's something that we need to recognize, that this is a huge threat to civil liberties, but also for the abuse of power. We need to reimagine restraint mechanisms against policing at the most local levels. Our local law enforcement are now hyper-empowered with these surveillance technologies that largely fall in these legal voids. They're not properly regulated. We need to insert greater public accountability and oversight over what police are doing, especially given the history of racialized policing and abuse of power among police forces in every jurisdiction around the world.
that's a really well said, and it's a great note to finish on. One of the themes of Attack Surface, that's not really a spoiler, is that the idea that we can use cryptography and security technologies to build a kind of shadow world that lives alongside the so-called real world, where we don't have to have legitimate government because we can trump stupid laws with better technology, that dream is dead, and it's always been dead. That to survive, if you want to make your technology to make you secure against police incursion, you have to never make a mistake, and they only have to find one mistake that you've made. And that while technology can offer you some security, and it's important to defend that, that the thing that we should use that security to do is to construct and demand legitimate governments, governments responsive to the people. You know, that it doesn't matter how many bits your key has if you've been tied to a chair and are being hit with a rubber hose. Mm-hmm. That the thing to use with cryptography for is to make that illegal. Mm-hmm. All right. I think that the Strand is going to pop back in here. Hi. And I'm going to say, we're all going to say goodnight. I want to just one last thing mention that there are 7 more of these. Obviously, you don't need 7 more copies of Attack Surface, although you could build a fort. But there is a list. If you look on pluralistic.net or on crapon.com, you'll find it. There is a list of libraries, halfway houses, prisons, classrooms, universities, and schools that have requested copies. And so if you want to come to one of the other nights and you don't want another copy of the book as a Christmas gift or whatever, you can put down one of their addresses and just there's a link to email me and I'll cross them off. And there's also a link there to add your own name if you're with an institution that's looking for a copy or if you know someone who is. So help me get the word out.
Corey, thank you for mentioning that. That is really important. And thank you to all 3 of you for having this discussion tonight. It's very timely and fascinating, you know, as someone who's not very plugged into the world of cybersecurity and all of that, this was really cool. Probably going to watch this again later. By the way, if anyone would like to watch this again later, you can use the same exact Crowdcast link and password that you were sent an email to watch the recording. So feel free if any of this was a little too dense for your brain, like me. But yes, thank you all so much for coming, Ron, Eva, and Corey. This was delightful. And if anyone has yet to purchase a copy, you can do so at the green button in the middle of the screen or the middle bottom of the screen. And yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Ron. Eva, thank you so much for coming. We really made my night, and so lovely to see you. Next time we'll do this in the Rare Book Room at the Strand. It's a great place awesome. To hold a venue. And thank you to, I miss the Strand. Give my regards to Broadway.
I will. We miss you. All right. Take care, everyone.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.